Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm producer Caleb, and I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and our guest today, Dr. Dan Van Voorhis. If you've been listening for the last couple of weeks, you know we are at the beginning of our brand new series, The Great Thinkers of the Christian Faith. And one of the major goals of this series is to bring as many current great minds as we can to talk about some of these historical figures who have set the groundwork that we now have in our belief system, in the way we see Christianity, in the way we worship and read the scriptures. And so we're trying to bring this knowledge to you. We're essentially doing lay-level education. So we are going to hit very surface level. We might get deep into certain topics, but if you're left wanting more, we're going to try to give you book recommendations at the end of each episode so that you can go read from this person some of the writings of whoever we're talking about each week and maybe some biographies about them. And you can always feel free to email us if you feel like you didn't get enough, and we'll try to send you some resources your way. So without further ado, Dr. Keith, you want to start us in on today's episode?
Sure. Welcome, Dan. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. I'm on the Smart Guy Show. 1517.
I think you guys usually call it the Old Guy Show.
The Old Guy Show, the Smart Guy Show, the Focused Show that doesn't go all over the place.
Jeff came last time around, and he said we were like run like clockwork, like some sort of German machine, I think was.
Oh, God.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And then Rod poked him in the eye.
Yeah. I'll say that. I didn't think we were that regimented.
Well, compared to us, anyone's regimented.
The late Tom Oden, early on in the White Horse Inn, dubbed us all the young fogies.
The young fogies. I
was younger then.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can always say that. You want to see a picture of me when I was younger? Yeah, of course. All pictures are that.
Well, a picture of you 30 seconds ago. All right, let's go. Yeah. So we're going to have you on two episodes talking about two different people.
Yeah.
For today, we're going to be talking about Johann Arndt, right?
Yeah, guy close to me.
Why do you know about
dear
this,
to my heart?
Well,
my PhD ended up being on Johann Arndt. So I've written 100,000-word dissertation on Johann Arndt. I spent about 4 years working on him. And I lived and breathed and was in his hometown and in his parish and everywhere. So Johann Arndt is sort of my guy. He is vastly understudied. And that was the reason I went with him. I probably wouldn't have, except for the fact that I found out how influential he was, how important he is, and how we in America or in the English-speaking world don't really do anything with him.
Right.
Partly because he falls in between two stools, and partly because nothing or hardly anything is translated into English. That has changed, and within the next year, first book recommendation for you, will be my book on Johann Arndt.
Good.
Brought to you by New Reformation Press.
Awesome.
So,
What? Give me the basic time period here for Johann Arndt, and maybe set up what was going on at the time when he's alive and his influences and whatnot.
Sure. So he lives, as I mentioned, he falls between two stools, theologically, but also in terms of time. His years are 1555 to 1621.
So for just setting up a frame of reference in my head, we're talking about almost 10 years after Luther's
dead,
death.
And we have Lutheranism now legal in the empire, right, with the Peace of Augsburg. And now we have the Catholics and the Lutherans, right? The Reformed are still illegal. And this is the transition period. This is really the Lutheran Church trying to figure out, who are we? Luther's dead, now what? And that's the question. And it's going to be a question of, are we taking Luther's legacy? Are we taking the confessions, right, that we've created and then they continue to create? This is the age of a number of heavy hitters in the Lutheran Church.
Right, Melanchthon's still alive.
Chemnitz's years? What are Chemnitz's years?
He's still in there, too.
He's in there.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
You know, Robert Preuss, called this the golden age of Lutheran Orthodoxy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's fair. I think we want to play with that just a little bit, because it certainly was in terms of what people were doing in terms of getting the confessions done, but that didn't quite pick up in the parishes themselves. And that's what some of my work did and some other people's work did. Bob Kolb, who has been on the show before, that some of his work has done that. He was a real mensch, really helpful with my dissertation.
Good for him.
Absolutely. Yeah, for a scholar to reach out in an email and say,
yep,
here's a paper I gave that wasn't published. do something with it.
So, great.
He's a great guy. And what ends up happening is the parish, the people in the parish aren't getting the confessions. They're not getting, we don't want to overdo it, but, Luther, when he died, thought the Reformation had failed because the word had come back from the pastors that no one knew their stuff.
Yeah, this is a common theme with, the visitations and things like that earlier
there's
in the Reformation.
There's a guy named Gerald Strauss. Gerald Strauss at the University of Indiana did this whole book called Luther's House of Education. He pushes the thesis too far, saying the Reformation was a failure. We don't want to say, because what the people believe in the parish, so goes the church. Now, it can, of course, but think of the churches you might go to today. Does everyone in the parish get it? In the churches today, in the LCMS, if you went and said, what's the Book of Concord? Mm-hmm. Would they know?
I've done that.
Yeah, with your catechism, your second catechism, right?
It's an interesting response. I mean, I think one of the things I found lately is that in some churches it's a little bit better, but on the whole, Lutherans are aware of the small catechism.
Yeah.
And the creeds.
Exactly.
That's what they have to study.
Yeah.
And that's, when you look at some of the Book of Concord, it gets pretty meaty.
Sure
it is.
And
yeah, it
think of just literacy, right, in the 16th century. So we want to be careful calling it the golden age. It is certainly in terms of creating things, but in terms of what's happening in the church, this is a precarious time.
Yeah.
The Lutheran church was teetering because now you have the Reformed. And the Reformed in 1559, so this is right after when Arndt's 4 years old, you get the definitive version of Calvin's Institutes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Calvin wrote it in French and Latin. French is the language of Europe. It's no longer Latin. It's moved to French. And now the Reformed are starting to, as they're persecuted, grow. Mm-hmm. And so the Lutheran church is sort of dwindling, and the Reformed church is coming up. So he lives during this time period, and he dies in 1621. That's significant because in 1618, the 30 Years' War began.
Right.
The 30 Years' War essentially starts out as a religious war, and then turns into a battle for territory and political gain. But nonetheless, it's probably the event that ends the Reformation century.
Right.
If you think of 1517 and then 1618, that's about the 100 years of the Reformation. So he's living at the very last half of the Reformation.
So that's his time period. So give us a little bio on Arndt here. Who are his influences? What's his early life like?
Yeah, he's raised in a Lutheran home. It's nothing too out of the ordinary. His parents were, by all accounts, devout, and he makes reference to that in a letter to Johann Gerhard. And he likes Luther.
Well, that's an interesting thing to say, that he's raised in a Lutheran home. You really would have had Lutheranism as a thing, maybe, could you say, since the Augsburg Confession, since 1530?
Well,
Lutheran homes have been around for maybe like 20 years by the time he's born, 25.
Yeah. And as well, the idea of Lutheran does start in the 1520.
Right.
So if he says Lutheran, he might not mean the established Lutheran church, but a home that
parents
followed.
Influenced by Luther.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so he's influenced by Luther. And he's influenced by Luther more than the Confessions.
Gotcha.
He goes to the University of Strasbourg for a while, and this is a hotbed of the Reformed.
Reformed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he gets involved in the battles and actually fights with Lutheran theology against the Reformed. And this is something, once again, that he'll bring up later in his letters as he's trying to defend himself. And I'll get to that in a second. So Johann Arndt grows up in a Lutheran home, goes to a university where he is, by all accounts, a guy who's fighting for Lutheranism against the Reformed, and then he becomes a parish pastor. Hmm. And this is what he did his entire life. So he didn't teach, he didn't write much, he was a pastor. And for him, it was Luther. And primarily the younger Luther, and then primarily his secondary sources are those people that Luther used from the Middle Ages.
Hmm.
So it's the Theologica Germanica.
Mm-hmm.
It's Bernard of Clairvaux, right? These are the people that Arndt sees Luther reading, so Arndt reads.
Okay.
So as we're starting to look at his
Formation,
his sort of internal Lutheranism, or his piety, right? Not pietism. That comes about 60 years later. Mm-hmm. His piety, it's formed by early Luther and the mystics that Luther used.
Interesting.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's going to argue that when they say you used so and so, he's going to say so did Luther. Uh-huh. And he's got a point. Uh-huh. Now, there's a question in the Lutheran Church when he's in about 1600, when he gets into trouble, and that is the place of the confessions and the place of Luther. Once again, Bob Kolb has done great work on this. Luther is still the prophet of the Reformation. Mm-hmm. And if you invoke him, it's hard to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. So this is who he's reading. He's in the parish. Of course, when someone's in the parish, they've got a certain... Sometimes they'll have a certain bent, or they're dealing with what's on the ground. Sure. And so he writes, you know, a prayer book, and he writes pretty simple things for the laity. One of his parishioners was Johann Gerhard. There is no, I believe, there is no greater devotional writer than Johann Gerhard.
Yeah.
You know, we think of devotional and we might think of...
We think of junk.
Yes.
We do.
My utmost for his highest, is that what the...
Oh! Yeah.
And Gerhard...
I one time insulted that on the White Horse Inn. Yeah. We were live, the whole phone bank lit up like a Christmas tree.
That's great.
Now, I've not read it. I just know the title, and it's silly, My Utmost for His Highest, because for me, that is devotional. And when we say devotional, sometimes people will kind of cringe a little bit.
Yeah.
Having devotion, I mean, isn't a bad thing.
No.
It's taken in a different way. No. Just like having piety isn't a bad thing.
No. Yeah. No, if it's informed and wonderful thing.
Yeah.
But My Utmost for His Highest is the devotional book probably of North America more than any other.
Yeah. Still?
More than a Kempis.
Sure.
Imitation of Christ. But they're cut from the same cloth. The background to My Utmost for His Highest is what you'd call in later years Keswick, yep. Wesleyan perfectionism.
Yeah,
that's the theological backbone of the thing, and it's in every Lutheran parish I know.
It is. It is the book. It's the thing that's handed out. It's like that footprints thing that you see everywhere.
And I'm going to put this in the show notes as a reference, not necessarily saying use it as your devotion.
No.
So if you're looking at the show notes, you know, take it that this is so you can see what this is.
And let me tell you, there's Johann Gerhard has a devotional. And
he does.
It came through Magdeburg Press, which I know we know something about with 1517. Mm-hmm. So I believe...
Well, we are now.
We are.
Now,
so we will have the rights to Johann Gerhard. And primarily, there is a piece, and it is for Lent, leading up to Easter. And it is essentially using, I think, the Gospel of Luke, and it's just sort of walking to the cross. Mm-hmm. And it is fantastic. It really is amazing. This is something that wasn't published in America, wasn't translated until like the 70s. So we find the translation problem oftentimes distances Americans, not only because of geography, but because of language. And they're really important books, but just haven't been translated.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes they were translated so long ago, some of them, that we've lost touch of the fact that there is a translation available.
If you're going to look at something, the Sacred Meditations.
Yes.
That's the work you're going to look at for Gerhard.
Yes.
And if you want to look at Lutheran devotion, Lutheran piety, Lutheran what have you, it's that.
Yeah.
And it's going to use Luke, and it's going to walk you right to the cross.
That's really cool.
Yeah, there it is. There's what devotional should be.
Yeah, I like that you said it's a walk to the cross.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
It really does highlight the focus.
And like I said, we're going to be putting it out with 1517 at some point. So
yep.
I'll
on the schedule.
Be involved with that. But so anyway, so Arndt is Gerhard's pastor. And so Gerhard, early on, gets very ill. And... says, you know, what so many people say, if you heal me, I'll become a pastor, right? Okay, well, that's what he did.
If you deliver me, I'll become a monk. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Isn't that what happened to you, Adam? That's something, because you were going that direction. I've got a picture of you with the collar. The, I think it's important to see that Gerhard is following the best of Arndt. And Arndt is this kaleidoscopic or Janus-faced, looking two directions, character. It's really a confusing thing, and this is one of the reasons, not only his time period, but he's so difficult to understand when you read, especially the only things that are published, even the things in German and Latin, because there was more that he wrote. And my dissertation, the book, has actually miraculously uncovered things that hadn't been translated or published before. And so it gives us an even bigger picture of this very curious character. Rod, I remember we talked years and years ago in the Festschrift for you. Mm-hmm. I was in the middle of my dissertation, mm-hmm. and so I wrote a piece. And I remember having a conversation with you. And your question, what was the basic gist? Because I thought it was a really, really maybe the question to ask about Arndt.
Well, I'm not sure what that was. I do remember asking you, how in the world did Arndt function as really one of the fathers of Pietism? And Gerhard and he were not only related, they were close yep. in every way. And your answer was, you're overlooking the obvious, Rod. And I said, and what is that? You said, Arndt spoke according to which audience was in front of him.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a terrible epithet for anybody.
Sure. And that was the question. That is the question if you're trying to figure out Arndt without getting into psychohistory, you know, yep. psychological history.
Right.
You just have to say, listen, he's writing to his audience.
Yeah.
And that can be sometimes appropriate, but not necessarily when you're, you know, actually contradicting yourself.
Yeah.
And that's what the University at Jena, Jena, J-E-N-A, that's what they end up taking him to task for. But they don't know a lot of what he's doing. And so they don't quite have things like his letters to Daniel Kramer. Daniel Kramer, C-R-A-M-E-R, is a fascinating character. He's an apocalyptic Lutheran. He's, you know, eventually kicked out of the church. He's following a guy named Paracelsus.
Oh,
Paracelsus is all over the place. And anyway, so Arndt writes to him and speaks that language. And there's a letter, I'm not trying to pump up anything except, you know, the book, a letter that's never been used, translated, and that's basically what my dissertation was.
Mm.
So that's Arndt's theological upbringing. It's Lutheran. It's following maybe Luther more than the Confessions, which sometimes I think is a good thing. But he's going to, his emphasis oftentimes is going to be just a little off. It's not that he doesn't believe things. In his letters, just about every letter, he says, I subscribe to the unaltered Augsburg Confession.
Good.
Over and over and over.
Good.
But just, it's sometimes the emphasis.
Right.
Now, he's also living during a time that a plague hits northern Germany, right. the northern German lands. That's going to affect you,
sure.
right? When you're dealing with dying people.
Sure. What's interesting that he's saying, I subscribe to the unaltered Augsburg Confession, because he's around, what are his dates again? I'm sorry,
1555 to 1621.
And so he first becomes active, what, probably about
1580s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's active after the Formula of Concord.
Yes.
Okay.
Could I throw something in? When we were talking about good devotionals. Listen to this one from Calvin. We see that our whole salvation and all its parts are comprehended in Christ. We should therefore take care not to derive the least portion of it anywhere else. If we seek salvation, we're taught by the very name of Jesus that it is of Him. If we seek any other gifts of the Spirit, they'll be found in His anointing. If we seek strength, it lies in His dominion. If purity, in His conception. If gentleness, it appears in His birth. For by His birth He was made to like us in all respects, that He might learn to feel our pain. If we seek redemption, it lies in His passion. If acquittal, in His condemnation. If remission of the curse, in His cross. If satisfaction, in His sacrifice. If purification, in His blood. If reconciliation, in His descent into hell. If mortification of the flesh, in His tomb. If newness of life, in His resurrection. If inheritance of the heavenly kingdom, in His entrance into heaven. If protection, if security, if abundant supply of all blessings, in His kingdom. if untroubled expectation of judgment in his power given him to judge. In short, since rich store of every kind of good abounds in him, let us drink our fill from this fountain and from no other. Hmm. Now that Christocentricity in a devotional marks it.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, we're recording this during the season of Lent. And when Lent is done right, mm-hmm. it is something else. Jeff, my co-host on Virtue in the Wasteland, says that that Ash Wednesday is his favorite holiday because he's dark and strange. But he loves how it just brings that sort of devotional life to the cross. And this is, you know, one of the songs that maybe my favorite song that we sing during Lent is O Sacred Heart Now Wounded.
O Head Now Wounded.
Sacred Head Now Wounded. There you go. Mm-hmm. And that was written by Bernard of Clairvaux, mm-hmm. who's a mystic that Luther loves. Mm-hmm. And that is a fantastic hymn.
Absolutely.
And it's the kind of thing that you know, Calvin is writing here, that it's devotional, but it's not my utmost for his highest.
Nope.
It's Christ
fulfilling every aspiration that I've got.
Yeah. And frankly, this Arndt can do that well. Mm-hmm. He taught Gerhard some of this. I mean, he does it well. And then at other times, he goes into, some things that his emphasis maybe should be elsewhere. But he's just such a difficult character to get a hang of, unless you just say, well, he's just writing to his audience. And to his parish, you know, his sermons are good.
Good.
You know, so it's one of those things where
good.
It's hard to fault him. Now, oftentimes when you do hear of Arndt, you'll hear of two things. One is pietism.
Yep.
Pietism is a theological movement as much as it is a social movement. That is, it has certain things, certain markers, without which it's no longer pietism. It is, an emphasis on fulfilling the Reformation or finishing what they didn't quite get to, which, mm-hmm. all right. Mm-hmm. Then it's,
the Reformation meant to go this far, but they just ran out of time and circumstances.
Yeah. Yes,
came upon
that's
them.
The usual.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, obviously, I'm not going to either. It's got everything, right? It's not like it didn't have good works or devotion or these things. It was there. Mm-hmm. But they want an emphasis. So the next part of pietism is emphasis on the affections. It's an emphasis on now the heart over the head sometimes.
What Rome calls the renewal.
Yeah. So those are two emphases, but the other thing that it has is it's highly unionistic. And that is that the Lutherans would say, well, we're going to get together with the Reformed. We're going to get together with whatever the Anabaptists are doing right now.
Right, which makes sense if it's a heart over the head type thing.
Yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Because the catechisms don't really matter.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And this is pietism. Now, pietism begins, the last thing, sorry, is the home church. The ecclesia, in ecclesia.
Oh.
That means, you know, everyone goes to church, but not everyone at church is a true Christian.
Yep.
You know, like I'm sitting next to Adam in church and I'm thinking that guy.
My small group is the real Christians.
Exactly.
And Sunday morning is everybody.
Exactly.
You bet.
And that marks...
Conventicles.
Conventicles, absolutely. And that's going to carry into America. That is, instead of a catechism, the main work in pietism is the Pia Desideria.
Yeah.
The Pia Desideria is written by Philip Jacob Spener, S-P-E-N-E-R. And he is the father of pietism.
Okay.
Now, he takes this little book by Arndt called Little...
True Christianity?
Not True Christianity, The Little Garden of Paradise.
Okay.
But devotional. And not bad. Not terrible. And he writes an introduction to it because it's very popular. And that introduction is On the Pious Desires, Pia Desideria. And then that starts to, people start to get the Little Garden of Paradise so they can read the Pia Desideria. Soon it comes out on its own. And instead of a catechism, you have the Pia Desideria, which is almost all affection.
All right, we're going to stop there for our first break. We'll come back. We'll learn a little bit more about Arndt. Thanks, Dan, again.
We're going to get into America, because Arndt comes to America, and he's going to influence all of our churches.
I mean, this is great stuff.
Terrific intro.
You're telling me stuff that I really never learned before, so I love it. Thanks.
All right, not a problem.
All right, we'll catch you in a minute.
Hey, Hey, this is Dan Van Voorst. Thanks for listening to the show where I'm a guest. It's fun to be on this show. You might know that I'm a co-host of Virtue in the Wasteland with Dr. Jeff Mallinson, but my other job is I'm the executive director or director of the League of Faithful Masks.
You can be executive.
Can I call it myself executive? Thank you, boss. I am now executive director of the League of Faithful Masks. Fine. League of Faithful Masks is a silly name, but I'm going to explain it real fast. The League of Faithful Masks is started by Uwe Simonetto, who has been on our podcast and is all over themasks.org. Themasks.org. The League of Faithful Masks is a left-hand kingdom operation. And we have 1517, mm-hmm. and we have a right-hand kingdom and a left-hand kingdom.
Yep.
As part of Lutheran.
We've done that on the show. They can reference our episode on two kingdoms.
Yeah. I'll tag that episode right on
here. Yeah. So, you know, this is something that that Jeff and I do. I'm the executive director now. And essentially what we do is we try to focus on everyday work. Our point is that God uses the physical, everyday presence of people to feed and clothe and educate us. That's, you know, your job is your ministry. And you don't have to have something else. Your work is meaningful, and it's how God uses you as a mask, larvae dei, mm-hmm. to serve your neighbor. So League of Faithful Masks, it's been around for a while. We just relaunched it 2 weeks ago in Dallas. It's got a brand new site, very sharp site, a lot of articles by myself, by Jeff, by Uwe. And it is a place that you can check it out and look for chapter meetups. One of the things with League of Faithful Masks is we're sort of going against the e-culture. So rather than blogs, we're putting out a hard journal. Rather than sort of talking to people through podcasts, which obviously we all like, we're starting chapters where people get together and they talk. And they talk about their jobs, and that bleeds over into Reformation. So we had our inaugural in Dallas. I'll be going to Seattle and New York, where other chapters will be opening in the next couple of months. Go to themasks.org, see what we're all about, and who knows, you can join the chapter.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dan.
Yeah,
it's a great website. I'm poking around on it right now.
Yeah.
If you're interested in it, it actually has some information there on becoming a mask, starting a chapter. You can find out more about the current masks, like Dr. Jeff Mallinson. The Klimbaros are both on there. Dan Seidel.
Micah Bornay, who's Micah a fascinating Bornay. Guy.
I read your manifesto last night.
Yeah.
It's great. it's complete.
Okay, good. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. We have, if you're interested what we do, you can go to the website and it says the Mask Manifesto and then what we do. And you can read that.
Absolutely. And there's a whole thing there on about vocation. I think even as at these early stages of the website, it's a very good resource. People should check it out. Themasks.org. Themasks.org. Check it out.
All right.
Great. So we're going to finish this up. You said we're going to talk about, during the break, that we're going to talk about Arndt in America.
Yeah.
And some of the
impact. Well, I have a question, though, first,
yeah.
before we get to Arndt in America. I want to know, you keep talking about he got in trouble. What's the deal? So thus far we know he's raised by Lutherans. He goes to Strasbourg. Where does he finish? Does he finish at Strasbourg?
Yes.
Okay, so he finishes at Strasbourg. So he's sort of in the middle of this Calvinist soup there at Strasbourg, Reformed soup there at Strasbourg. He eventually makes it back into Lutheran territory, right? Because he becomes...
a pastor and then a superintendent of churches
Lutheran
in Brandenburg.
Superintendent of pastors. He's got at least one influential theologian in his congregation.
Very influential.
Right. Yeah. Are there others there with him or...
You know, that's really, I mean, he is a parish pastor. You know, he's not out at colloquies. He's not part of the people who are working with theological controversies, you know, with the magisterial or the second generation of reformers, rather. So he's not really connected to a lot. Now, when he's church superintendent, that means he's sort of the guy, bishop.
He's a district president.
He's the district president of the Northeast German territories.
Right.
So, yeah, he is there, but how he gets in trouble ties into how he gets to America. So I'll make this transition. He writes the most popular book in Christian history in the early modern era.
Well, that's great, because my next question would be, what are his major works? So
Johann Arndt writes a book called True Christianity. True Christianity is published between 1605 and 1610. He works on it and puts different books in it, and it catches on like wildfire. Now, book culture is really interesting in the late 16th and early 17th century. because books are now getting cheaper. And now books are becoming a kind of symbol. They say who you are.
So your library.
Your library.
Status symbol.
Absolutely.
I like that, actually. If it's going to be a status symbol, it should probably be your library.
And what is Arndt's book called? True Christianity, right? We love those things, those modifiers, which I forget who said it, but someone said that they're the enemy of the gospel.
It was Dr. Nagel.
Dr. Nagel.
Watch out for the adverbs.
Adverbs are the enemy of the gospel. Yeah. I truly repent.
Yeah. So Johann Arndt writes his book, True Christianity, and you got the title. It's pretty easy to read. He gets into some esoteric things, which people always love. He's also, just to be fair, he's also a pharmacist. He picks up...
alchemy somewhere?
Alchemy,
like
yeah.
Like a California-style
pharmacy? No, but like,
metals and gold.
So he's actually working as kind of a doctor during the plague, a doctor and a pastor. Right. So, fascinating. He writes his book, True Christianity, and it takes off like wildfire. It's translated into 28 languages.
Wow.
For the first time since The Imitation of Christ was published in the 14th century, Johann Arndt's True Christianity becomes the second most best-selling book in Western Europe. It dethrones the book, the Bible, and then The Imitation of Christ. Mm-hmm. For about 100 years, it's the Bible, True Christianity, The Imitation of Christ.
Huh. Really?
Like I said, 28 languages. It goes everywhere.
All European languages?
No.
Are there 28? I don't think there are.
No, he's right. So I mean, it's translated.
Chinese and...
It's translated on this, like, almost looks like a, like, bark from somewhere in Southeast Asia. And I got to see one of those. So it's, you know, it's translated into every language. And it's translated into English by the English Puritans. Because there's a sort of a connection there with the Puritans and the Pietists.
No kidding.
Oftentimes we think. you know, this is the connection. We probably have heard about Puritans before, many of us. That's, you know.
The guys with the big hats.
Exactly. Okay. What's a Puritan?
And the belt buckle on.
What is on Puritan? The Quaker Oats
exactly.
Box there. Yeah.
What is Puritanism? The sneaking suspicion that somewhere someone is having fun. That's H.O. Mencken. But Pietism is part of that. Why? Because True Christianity. Because now the Puritans get interested in Arndt and who Arndt is referencing. The late medieval mystics, primarily. Arndt's book goes to the New World. And it becomes, in the colonies, the first book published in German. The first Lutheran book, if you will, say, you know, written by a Lutheran. It's published by a guy named Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin realizes this will sell. And it does.
So Arndt truly does come to America.
Arndt comes to America. And this book is published in a number of times in the late 18th century, late 1700s and the early 1800s. And that's really the last time it was ever translated. So if you want to get a version of it, you got to go there in English. People have translated parts of it, but it's always sort of parts of it. No one just does the whole thing, you know, books 1 to 6. There's arguments why, but that's beyond the pale. So True Christianity comes to America. It makes its way to the Mississippi, right? It makes its way, obviously, to the Germans, where the Germans are. And it becomes sort of the playbook, the catechism for Lutheranism in the early Germans. So think of, who are some of the early Germans in America? What's the big guy who's
Mühlberg.
Not
Walter?
Mühlberg, yeah. Mm-hmm. They love Arndt.
Yeah.
And it's not a terrible book, but why not throw in the catechism as well?
Yeah, really.
Why not throw in, you know, the Augsburg Confession?
Yeah.
And that is...
You could say why not to a lot of other things.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But... I think that's really important, that the failure to bring other books to say True Christianity is enough, the Bible and True Christianity. Yeah. So, and that's the early Americans. Leave it to the Americans to mess it up. And that's why I think American Lutheranism oftentimes has a certain flavor. True Christianity was very, very popular in Swedish. It was translated into Swedish almost right away. And then all the other Scandinavian languages. And so, Rod, you know something about the Scandinavians and pietism or an affectional theology without a catechism, and that's what happens to it. So Arndt would say, go to the unaltered Augsburg Confession. Go to Luther. You got to read these guys. And then after him, they're just reading him.
So his influence, his Luther influence, comes mostly through what? Like the catechism, the three treatises, or what's he reading?
Small catechism, and then a lot of Luther's books on prayer, Luther's sermons.
Okay.
Luther's sermons are huge for him.
Right.
And if you read Luther's sermons, I mean, I think we'd have Lutherans in America complaining about them.
Right.
Yes. I think we'd have modern confessional Lutherans, whoever they are,
yes.
Complaining about Luther's sermons.
Yes.
And I don't know, I'm just a historian. I don't know all this
stuff. Historian who did a dissertation on Johann Arndt.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned a couple of years ago to me how much Gerhard defended Arndt.
Which is sort of an
interesting thing based on our sort of perceptions of Gerhard and Arndt.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Gerhard would fight for him over and over at the big seminaries in Germany, the confessional seminaries, and Gerhard would say, yeah, would you read all of his works? Would you read, his sermons? He's fine. So that's Gerhard is saying he's got a whole theology. And this is what Gerhard is really going to do well. Mm-hmm. But with Arndt, this is his main work. He writes some funny letters, which give us pause. But at the same time, it's not all his fault, right? People took what they liked of him, which was the devotional part, separate from the theology. Now, maybe he could have done what Gerhard did and brought those two together in one text. But in true Christianity, we have a lot of references, really good references to, sort of Christocentric, cross-centered justification outside of you. The stuff Luther's doing, the freedom of the Christian, that's huge for Arndt.
Right.
The freedom of the Christian, which is...
I think it's interesting. I think we have not everybody, but the 16th century is known as a very polemic age, right? These guys, Luther would go after people with both barrels and do it quite frequently. But at the same time, if you even just take the relationship of Luther and Melanchthon as an example, there's really no evidence that Luther ever went at Melanchthon publicly for errors, perceived or otherwise, that were occurring while Luther was still alive,
right,
and that were credited to Melanchthon as erroneous doctrines, bad moves concerning the will or predestination or whatever.
As the historian in the room, just as a we have to remember, these are people. These are people. And so while we're looking at their theology, I was mentioning during the break to Rod that with Calvin, the quote that Rod read to from Calvin, and I mentioned Bruce Gordon, who's my supervisor, one of my supervisors, my primary supervisor, he wrote a book on Calvin that really deals with Calvin, the person, and that's important.
Yeah. Another thing I think that's worth mentioning, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, the impression was very quickly picked up, and I think it's not mysterious, that what Arndt was saying underneath it all was he wanted a living Christianity. And the underbelly of that was more than just that you subscribe.
Right.
And that was, for many people, understandable. We want a living Christianity, not something that's utterly formal.
That's very common, too, with the Norwegian Lutherans. And what I was going to say, the comparison with Luther and Melanchthon and Gerhard and Arndt, is that you get the sense that these were, like Dan was saying, were people. And that they lived with each other, they loved each other, and that they weren't quite as willing to sort of go at one another as we might think they should have been because of their repute, right, about being sort of these go-getters and tearing out the weeds and the thistles like Luther even described of himself. And I think it's interesting, you could say the same concern, Melanchthon had the same concern that took him and caused him to make some moves that were different than Luther as Arndt and Gerhard.
And think of
a living Christianity, one that is recognizable in the everyday life.
I think, though, it's important to note that's absolutely true. The good works in Lutheranism, to tie it back to the commercial we did about the masses,
you don't
see them. And
right. Or you do see them.
You do see them.
And they're so obvious you don't recognize them.
Exactly. God himself uses the hand of the farmer to bring you milk.
Right.
And that's important.
You don't notice it when a father or a mother is they're bathing their children mm-hmm. and putting up with their crap the whole time before mm-hmm. they get them to bed. And you don't look at that and recognize and say, that's a godly work.
That's, mm-hmm. that's good works, not yeah. Not starting a basketball ministry.
Right. Adam walks his son down here to help him mow the lawn. You know, he doesn't have to do that. But he does it because he's his dad. That's a good work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look at Adam.
And, you know, at times that's going to... When you want a living Christianity, you want something you can see.
Right.
And it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. We want something we can see. Yeah. Verifiable. I want to see this. And then when I see all those, then I'll say, I don't know if there's a controversy about this stuff today, but back then, this idea on good works and third use of the law, it was really interesting because, you know, it was understood by a lot of these Lutherans that it's just happening. Luther says, a Christian cannot help but do good works.
Yeah.
And then he moves on.
Yeah.
Don't worry, you're doing it.
And in other places, he says, the last thing in the world you should do is to check internally.
Yeah.
Draw up some sort of a success chart. He was totally opposed to all success charts.
Yeah.
Well, how are you going to do that? I bathed my child 4 times this week instead of 7.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's, I don't, I that's the thing.
For, if, I had my kids for
if
5
you,
days, I didn't
if
bathe
you
once.
Sort of gauge good works on something that can be put on a checklist, you're seeing it wrong. Where I went on 2 mission trips. I served as an elder for 10 years.
And it serves really, really quick. And this is, we talk about this. There's a video on the masks where we talk about this. Mm-hmm. And it can be crippling.
Yep.
When you think your job as an accountant isn't enough, and so you've got to start a ministry on the side, that's going to kill your time, nothing else.
You could even say it will be.
It will be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what you're doing, that's you're serving people. Do your job well.
Very difficult for evangelicals to understand. Yeah. You say, I design a wing at Boeing or McDonald's. And they say, well, no, that's not what I'm asking. That's your job.
Making. That's your tent-making job or something like that.
No, I'm asking about what do you do in ministry.
Right.
And that's foreign to us.
Yeah. I'd say it's about 60% of the being dad shtick when I go out and teach on the book and being dad. It's about, listen, this is a vocational endeavor, and that's meaningful. Yeah. In ways that you probably don't even realize.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you get it from the crowds, well, I haven't done this well enough, and I say the same thing. You're seeing this like an accountant. You've probably done this 1,000 times more than you even recognize. Because it's every day, it's mundane, it's...
The classic passages in Matthew, when did we do those things for you, Lord? Mm-hmm. When did we do those things for you?
I was just living my life.
Yep.
Absolutely.
I think the problem we run into in Lutheranism with this is that we think we have vocation nailed, and that we teach it so well, and everybody knows the word. But I don't think it often registers to this level.
We're kind of off topic here, but when we teach it very concretely, which is good, because we'll say things like Luther's quote, a bootmaker that makes quality boot and sells at a fair price, doing so to the glory of God. But that doesn't necessarily communicate sort of the mundane nature of the everyday stuff that is your vocation.
Yeah. And just real fast, be careful when you say, I do this to the glory of God. Fine, but it's for my neighbor.
Yeah.
Right. To the glory of God. Because we talked about that with the masks. That's how does God serve people? Using other people.
One of the things I'll say when I'm teaching on the being dad is when people become a Christian, they often ask, well, what can I do for God now? And they hate his answer. Because it's nothing. You can do nothing for me. I'm creator of heaven and earth. All things came into existence because of my spoken word, and thus does your salvation as well. So what do I need? I need nothing. But you know what? I've put you here because there are other people who need you.
Yeah. Teacher, what's the will of God?
Neighbor. Yes.
What's the will of God? Well, it's that you do this and the Bible study and then the small group. No, it is that you would believe in his son, and that's the will of God.
Yeah, serve your neighbor.
To take this into Arndt, Arndt is... going to have an understanding of this. Arndt is, he can talk this language. And I don't want to say he's being disingenuous.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't want to read into that. It's that he's doing other things with other audiences that we brought up earlier. And that's an easy way to criticize him. And Rod, you said, if that's your on your tombstone, that you just change your message to suit your audience. Now, there's one thing to translate your message. Right?
Sure.
You're talking a seminary or you're talking in a parish.
But that is...
That's translating.
Yeah.
That's not altering.
Right.
And so that's what Arndt often did, and he'd pick up some of the bad stuff. And Gerhard himself said, Arndt's a better preacher than he is a writer.
Right.
He, and then he thinks better than he writes. And I remember Bruce Gordon laughing and saying, it's like you, Dan. So that's, you know, Arndt comes to America. Arndt has got this emphasis. And, you know, his book is called True Christianity. It's known as the devotional work. People don't necessarily read it. They just say, well, that's the book, devotions, where's that? And then they go to other people that they probably shouldn't be, you know, in Scandinavia and in America. So Father of Pietism, not quite fair. Orthodox Lutheran, sometimes. difficult character. And,
it's,
you know,
like you.
I'm not going to, it is. It's not going to, you know, it, he's a guy that you know, read his Wikipedia page and become a little familiar with him, some of the links that we're going to put up, and then sometime in the future, we'll put out this book that I wrote that's just sitting on a shelf.
Yeah,
I can relate to that. The Thinking Fellows endorses Wikipedia. No.
No.
Hey, read whatever. Just put in Arndt and you get his dates and it tells you a little bit.
No, it's great. Yeah. Wikipedia is
don't
a great
cite
resource
in paper,
for the
though, kids.
Yeah, for the basics. All right, this has been a fantastic episode. Thank you for coming on the show once again, Dan.
Hey, thanks.
I will also link the episodes that Dan has been on the show in the past, just in case you want to hear more of these types of conversations.
If you want to go to also themasks.org, we're going to start putting up videos. I did an 8-part series on history of Pietism at our parish. It's been recorded and they can catch that there.
Great. And I have one last note before we leave the show. Some of you may be panicking right now and saying, how many episodes did I miss? We're already at the end of the Reformation. I just listened to Augustine last week. That's because we're not going in chronological order. We kind of mentioned that at the beginning of the Augustine episode with Dr. Mallinson. Dr. Keith and I mentioned that in the little introduction that we did to this series. And I just want to remind you, these episodes are going to come to you as we can get guests on the show, right, and those particular great thinkers that they specialize in.
Yep.
Because the whole goal of this series is to get you the best of the best on these topics, right, and on these people. So if that means we're going to hop around history, that means we're hopping around history.
Maybe when it's all said and done and we're done with the series and you're no longer taking three languages at one time,
yeah,
we can organize them in the archives, not only according to when they aired, but by chronological order as well for the people.
That is totally possible. Yeah. We have a Lochi section right now. For those of you who listen to the Lochi series, you can go on our website and I'll link that. We have a Lochi section that has those topics laid out in order and has some translations that we've done there. And we'll eventually do that for the rest of the series too. I'll work on that for apologetics while we're doing this series, setting up the webpage for that. And then when this series comes to a close, we'll set up a Great Thinkers of the Christian.
Yeah, we can list it as they aired and chronologically.
Sure.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.